Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you. And it is a generational team that really brings out this program to you each and every day. And we reach 100 nations around the world. My son does most of the editing on the program. My father does most of the researching. We've got three generations that work this radio program just about every day. And it is good to have you tuned in with us today. Well, my friends, we monitor the breakdown of Western civilization and the breakdown of civilizations across the entire world on this radio program. And when we say the breakdown of civilization, we're just simply saying that when societies break down, when the family breaks down, when fatherhood breaks down, as it is in Europe, North America, and to some extent South America as well, when these things happen, it affects the way that we will live in the years to come. There's no getting around it. If the family is an important, vital social unit, and if it is breaking down and has been breaking down for the last 120 years since dad left the farm and mom left the home and the kids left the family in order to be plugged into the compulsory attendance laws and the child labor laws, and when the family disintegrated, everything began to disintegrate. It didn't take long before the systems begin to fall apart at the seams, and that's where we are today. Meantime, there's programs like ours that are trying to reestablish the socioeconomic system by way of family economies and by way of a generational legacy passed on from one generation to the next. When generations were severed from one another and when fathers no longer discipled children, then we began to develop the Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Z, Gen LMNOP sort of a thing. And that, of course, leads to the fracturing of society and the breaking down of our civilizations. Okay. Now, here's an article, Dave, from Time Magazine, debuting also in studio here, another homeschool dad of five. And this was a shocker of a cover. My wife showed me this yesterday. The me generation millennials are lazy, entitled narcissists who still live with their parents. Why they'll save us all. Okay, that's a contradiction in terms, of course. You know, the idea that somehow lazy, entitled narcissists who still live with their parents will save us all. Now, the fact that they live there with their parents is no big deal. Maybe they're establishing family economies, but no way. No way, no way, no way. They're playing video games while Rome burns, and they're burning up their parents' capital. That's what's happening, friends. In the millennial generation, they're not going to add anything to the economic system in the future. No, we're spending our great-grandkids into debt right now. We're using up the capital of all the previous generations. And the millennials are right in the middle of it doing the same thing. Now, the reason why we want to bring this kind of stuff out to our listening audience is because the spirit of the age, the zeitgeist, tends to affect just about everybody, especially if you attend a church or your kids attend school or your kids have gone to college. They're going to be millennials. They're going to be pretty much whatever the world is like, because that's the people they hang out with day in and day out. So I just want you all to know what you're going to become, unless you come out from among them and be a little separate, unless you say, no, it's a different vision. We're establishing family economies here, and we're not playing the game the way the rest of them play the game, through their culture, their entertainment, their television, and their college classrooms. Unless you pull out of that and say, no, it's a completely different socioeconomic vision that we are bringing about in the 21st century, you're going to be like these millennials, and you're going to see your children effectively being the me generation. All about me. Millennials are lazy, entitled narcissists who still live with their parents. That's the front cover article in Time Magazine this week. Dave, a lot of interesting stuff in this magazine. They kind of review some of the previous generations, all the way back from the Lost Generation, the Greatest Generation, the Silent Generation. The Silent Generation being, of course, the most successful, born from 1925 to 1942, effectively joining the workforce in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. The Silent Generation were probably the most successful generation, economically speaking. Then the Baby Boom Generation began to use up the capital. They, of course, aborted 50 or maybe closer to 80 million babies in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. And they were suburban children who came of age in the summer of love, according to this article. In midlife, they became yuppies who lost fortunes in the stock market crash of 1987. Many have had their savings dented by the Great Recession and will postpone retirement. Then we move on to Gen X, born from 1961 to 1980. I happen to be a Gen Xer. Many were latchkey kids, working moms, divorced parents. These are the people we talk about, by the way, almost all the time on this program. They grew up into young adults marked by a sense of ennui. Studies have shown that members of this generation may have reversed this historical trend of earning more in real dollars than their parents. That is, they began to implode their basic economic system. They began to make less money than their parents because, guess what? But character does matter. And I know none of these articles think that character is even a factor in saving socioeconomic systems. None of these articles ever even think that maybe character could play into socioeconomic systems. None of the articles even care. They just don't care about the character whatsoever. They just say, hey, we're having a lot of fun. seeing the implosion of character and the breakdown of families in the 21st century. We're A-OK with that. And then you come from the Gen X generation, latchkey kids, divorced parents, imploding economic systems, onto the millennials, of course, doing even worse, born between 1980 and 2000, also known as Generation Y. They came of age in the shadow of 9/11 amid the rise of new media. First wave millennials are now in their early careers amid a slow global economic recovery with high unemployment and concerns about future national debt. Okay, so that's a summary of the generations according to the Time magazine article. And Dave, here's the summary of the millennial generation. They say that they're optimistic. That's the first thing they say. Is that the millennial generation more optimistic than the Gen Xers before them? And yes, they were born without parents and or born without fathers. And yes, they had highly dysfunctional backgrounds, way, way more dysfunctional than Gen X and the baby boom generation. Yes, 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 yes. All of that. Very, very dysfunctional. And yes, their socioeconomic system is collapsing on itself. But they're optimistic, and they're optimistic. And I say they're optimistic because they know things are bad. But because they're in the postmodern age, they laugh at the fact that things are going badly. And they have exited the ramps, the off ramps of reality, and they're out in the la la land of fantasy. And they their optimism is a pretense that just pretends everything is hunky dory. They're laughing at the fact that they're going to hell in a handbasket. They're laughing all the way down the tubes. And Dave, I think they're way off the highway of reality. Their optimism is laughing at their own pessimism, and this, I believe, is the optimism that characterizes the Gen X generation or the millennial generation. According to the article, their world is so flat, they have no leaders, which is why revolutions from Occupy Wall Street to Tahrir Square have even less chance than previous rebellions. They want constant approval. They post photos from the dressing room as they try on clothes. They have massive fear of missing out and have an acronym for everything. They're not going to church, even though they believe in God. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because they don't identify with big institutions. One third of adults under 30, the highest percentage ever, are religiously unaffiliated. They want new experiences, which are more important to them than material goods. They're cool, reserved, not all that passionate. They're informed, but inactive. They hate Joseph Kony, but aren't going to do anything about Joseph Kony. They are pro-business. The student loans have hit record highs. They have less household and credit card debt than any previous generation on record, which admittedly isn't that hard when you're living at home and using your parents' credit card. They love their phones, but they hate talking on them. They're not only the biggest generation we've ever known, but maybe the last large birth grouping that will be easy to generalize about. There are already micro-generations within the millennial groups, launching as often as new iPhones, depending on whether you are learning to type before Facebook, Twitter, iPads, or Snapchat. So yes, we have all the data about narcissism, laziness, entitlement. But a generation's greatness isn't determined by data. It's determined by how they react to the challenges that befall them, and just as important, by how we react to them. Whether you think millennials are the newest, greatest generation optimistic entrepreneurs, or a group of 80 million people about to implode in a dwarf star of tears when their expectations are unmet, depends largely on how you view change. Me, I choose to believe in the children. God knows they do. And that's Josh Sandburn writing the front page article for Time magazine, the me generation about the millennials. Dave, he's trying to be optimistic. Again, he himself being probably a millennial himself, trying to be optimistic about his own pessimism, understanding that millennials are lazy, entitled narcissists who still live with their parents. But he insists they're going to save us somehow. They're going to save us. That's what he chooses to believe. And Dave, it's almost like you're on the Titanic and there are people who are still doing workshops explaining why things are going so well and how everything's going to turn out just hunky-dory, despite the fact they have no data. He says you got to ignore the data. You just got to go without it. Who cares what the millennials are? Maybe somehow, maybe a miracle will happen. The millennial generation will save the Western world. And I say not so.
Kevin, he writes for Time magazine. He has to deny reality. What is there, like 200 paid subscribers left and they give away the rest of the copies to people who frequent fly and so forth. I mean, it's Time magazine. The magazine is barely able to buy ink at this point. It's interesting. He talks about greatness, and yet he doesn't define greatness. I don't think he has a clue what greatness is. What makes a generation great or not great?
Well, apparently, that's a good question. What makes them great is their ability to take pictures of themselves in dressing rooms and shopping centers. Apparently, the fact that they think that they're great. Well, they do. They think they're great. The millennial generation are the proudest people who probably have ever lived in the history of this country. And yet, those with the least amount of character, Dave, a lot of the young men I talk to seem to have a fairly amount of pride. And one of the questions I ask them is, what do you have to be proud about? It's one of my standard questions. What in the world do you have to be proud about? I can't think of anything, man. And you're one of the proudest people I've ever run into. The millennial generation, very, very proud, have very stinking little to be proud about, friends. And for that reason, they're not going to save anything. It's going to be the spectacular generation to fail that has ever happened, because they're about the proudest generation ever, and they do not have within themselves anything to really salvage human society and civilizations and economies in years to come.
What you're saying is they're great losers, but they have good self-esteem.
They
about
do.
It.
They do.
They've come to accept the fact that they're losers
do.
And they're okay
yeah.
with it now.
Yeah.
And this is what happens when you give kids awards for field day who didn't do anything, who didn't win. You know, you say competition is bad. Look, this is a generation that had a previous generation seen their plight, they would be weeping in tears, because there were previous generations who worked hard in order to have a better life for their children or their children's children. And up till the '70s or so, that was a dream and a reality that could happen. Nobody believes that anymore. Nobody believes that your children's children will have a better standard of living than you have right now today. In fact, right now, we're just hanging on for the last remnants of a high standard of living that's passing by. We have toys. Yeah, we have electronics that we didn't have before. But we look at reality. We look at the data. Those of us who are mature enough to look at data, we realize that officially the government's $16 trillion in debt, the federal government. You count all federal and state government debt, and you count the entitlements. That's money that's promised to be paid but isn't being paid out right now. It will have to be future payments. Things like retirements and Medicaid payments and Social Security payments. And the number this is the number I've heard now, is $240 trillion. Now, you have to be mature enough or good enough in math to realize that's more money than there is.
The millennial generation, according to a recent article for The Atlantic Magazine, the unluckiest generation, we covered that about 2 weeks ago. The millennial generation is one of the most cursed generations that have ever lived, friends, and they are as optimistic as the day is long. They're falling out of the 60-story building right around the seventh story. They're still saying, well, so far, so good. That's the kind of optimism you're getting out of the millennial generation right now. And the reason is, friends, they don't have the character. They don't have the morality. They don't have the social systems. They don't have a family vision that will sustain them in the next generation. They don't have the economy. They don't have the ability to function in the economy. Hey, you have young men playing video games while Rome burns. They have no reason to live. They have no reason to struggle and survive. They've crossed the line from materialism over into escapism. Remember that for the last 3 to 4 or 5 generations, from the silent generation onwards, there was a desire to get up, go to work, get your college degree, put your suit on in the morning, and get out there and earn your money and bring home the bacon and buy your 3-car garage and your et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All that was motivated by a materialistic vision. But the young men today have crossed over the line of despair from materialism to escapism. They're not motivated anymore by materialism. They're not motivated to make money. Remember the article we talked about them for the millennial generation being the unluckiest generation. They're a happy generation, optimistic generation, because they don't want to make any money. They don't see any real need to make any money. Their goal in life is to escape. Their goal in life is to play games while Rome burns. This is where the millennial generation has gone. And Dave, of course, don't forget the millennial generation most likely to believe in homosexual marriages, most likely to believe in evolution, the most likely to believe in socialism and government giving you womb to tomb stuff. Okay, so if that's the generation, the laziest generation, the most socialist generation, the most likely to try to collect money out of the government and get through life as easy as possible, the most likely generation to support homosexual marriage and destroy sexuality and destroy the family, if this be the millennial generation, which is what all the statistics is giving us right now, friends, forget about it. It's over. This is what the end of an empire looks like. If you ever wondered what it looked like to see the end of a civilization, this is what it looks like. What we're going to see, of course, is a fracturing of civilizations. You're going to see smaller civilizations of people who actually gained a vision in the year 2013 as they tuned into a Generations Radio broadcast or something similar. There will be some who will gain a vision to establish future families and future social systems. There will be some that will survive. Out of the millennial generation, there will be some who will survive. But boy, Dave, it's going to be weird. It's going to be different. Getting through the next generation is going to be interesting. I want to take a break right now and talk about the roots of this, Dave. I'm going to talk about my book, Apostate, because all of this is coming together, even as it's been effectively set by previous generations, by those idea men who set about to destroy the Christian faith and of course family as well, and to bring about a vision of atheism, homosexuality, materialism, and eventually escapism and nihilism. That comes from the philosophers from previous generations. My friends, this thing has been on trajectory for the last 250 years. It's no surprise whatsoever, not even a hint of a surprise, to know that civilizations are coming to a screeching halt because all of this has been set in motion over the last 250 years. My book, Apostate, is coming up next on the Generations broadcast. This is Kevin Swanson. We are back on the Generations broadcast. Kevin Swanson here, talking about the Time Magazine article where there's a little faint hope held out by Joel Stein and others who are writing on the millennial generation. Yeah, it's the me generation. Yes, yes, yes. Millennials are lazy, entitled narcissists, but they're going to save us all. They're going to save us all. Holding out just a little faint hope that somehow the millennial generation will save us all. Will save us all. You, I mean, it's stupid. It's just stupid.
You sound as pessimistic about the me generations as... Well, Windows Me. Remember Windows Me? Windows Millennium Edition?
Yeah.
And that failed. Yeah, and I'm thinking that
this
the Me generation
is as successful as the Windows Me generation. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, but I don't think there's an XP behind it.
I don't think so. Okay. There's no XP behind it, Dave. What comes after it but the mosaics? And the mosaics are even more trouble. Way, way more trouble than the millennial generation. Okay, my friends. Well, this all starts, of course, Dave, hundreds of years ago. This idea of the apostasy from the faith, the fact that you have streams of young people leaving the church. And that's what they admit here. They say they still kind of believe in God out there, not really sure what he looks like or what he's like or the fact that you have to get right with him or whatever. It's the God of their own imagination. But they've certainly left the evangelical church. They've left the Christian church. The church is bleeding big time right now in the Western world, in America. Of course, this happened in England already, so it's no surprise that it should eventually work its way into the United States, especially since the universities and the K-12 system has been as anti-theistic, anti-God, as it has been for the last 2 to 3 generations. No surprise whatsoever, my friends, that you take prayer out of the school, you take any kind of respect and reverence and fear for the living God out of the schools, and Christian families just dutifully send their kids to these schools to learn how not to fear the true and living God. And after about a generation or two of that, they walk away from the church. No surprise at all. This is what happens. We are looking at the demise of the Christian faith in America right now, and in my book, Apostate, I deal with how this began. It began with apostates, people who led the culture, people who effectively set the direction for the universities, for the political systems, and for the social systems and cultural systems, of course, in this country, were those who were apostates. Their parents and grandparents were godly Christian people. They were pastors. They were leaders. They were Christian leaders. They were missionaries. They were committed Christians, and it was their children who turned away from the faith and became some of the most aggressive anti-God philosophers that the world has ever known, and of course, eventually led some of the most severe revolutions that eventually produced the corruption of political systems and the murder of hundreds of millions of people in the 20th century. So the story is told in my book, Apostate, and Dave, the apostasy works its way through the philosophers who are the ones who are the masterminds, the great men, the Nephilim, I call them, who have tremendous influence upon the minds and hearts of billions of people around the globe. And eventually that affects the literary giants. That affects the Shakespeares, the Hawthorns, and the Mark Twains. Now, I know this introduces some controversy because people think that every great writer is a we're not worthy, we're not worthy. This is a great writer. We need to be in his presence and we need to sit at his feet and listen to what he has to say. And if that's the way we do our education, we teach our children to bow at the tables of these great literary giants who eventually are taught in the American high schools and American Christian colleges and such as great thinkers and great writers. And in the end, their ideas predominate in the minds of the kids who attended those colleges. And then after the literary Nephilim, that is the literary giants who had tremendous influence over the hearts and minds of millions and millions of academics, that is the movers and shakers in society, the people who would become the future university professors and political leaders, the universities and the literary giants eventually worked their ideas into the framework and fabric of the nation. And you had Nathaniel Hawthorne, then Mark Twain, then Hemingway and Steinbeck and all the great writers who had huge influence in American high schools and American colleges. And this became the real core material that kids read in these liberal arts high schools and colleges. And that trained them to be nice little apostates, just like Hawthorne and Twain were nice little apostates in the 19th century.
And then eventually, Dave, it seeps into the cultural Nephilim. And from the 1960s onwards, you have, you know, people not really reading the greats as much as they're listening to their iPods. And they're being influenced by the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and all the rest. So the last section of the book talks about the cultural Nephilim that are able to capture the hearts and minds of billions of people now, not just hundreds of millions, but billions of people around the globe. And they do so by mass producing the lyrics or the ideas of John Paul Sartre, Friedrich Nietzsche, and others in their songs. So, David, this whole system was locked up by these great Nephilim, these powerful, powerful cultural, philosophical, and literary and academic leaders, and they have accomplished great things. And Dave, the saddest thing about it all is that the Christian colleges and the Christian thinkers have not really engaged the conflict. They don't. And my book is a in your face. You know, take that, Hemingway, take that, Hawthorne, take that, Mark Twain, take that, Emerson.
Right.
Mine is in your face. These guys were wretched, horrific, God-hating wretches who formed the academic and intellectual ammunition that took down the Christian West. And I'm saying I'm done with it. I'm done with it. I'm a Christian. I'm one of the last Christians left. And I'm not going to compromise in this battle. I'm going to lay down the battle lines and fight this thing for everything I'm worth, and I'm hoping that there will be a Christian college professor out there willing to join me in this conflict. I'm hoping that there will be at least a couple of homeschool dads and moms that will engage the conflict in the high school classroom. And there's very little of this, what I call antithesis, going on. There's very little blood in the classroom happening anymore, and that's why we lose the battle. That's why we're losing the culture. That's why the moral majority and the Christian coalition are a total waste of time. Why? Because we're not engaging the battle. I mean engaging the battle of worldviews in the literature classrooms and in the liberal arts universities. That's what's killing this country and killing the faith in this country.
Yeah, and the name of the book, of course, is Apostate, The Men Who Destroyed the Christian West. And Kevin, my prediction is that this book is so incendiary to those who are of the classical education bent, those who love the classical literature and the classic authors, at least as it's been defined by the humanists, there will be people who defriend you. There will be people who will join your Facebook account just to defend you, to defriend you later. I said defend. Yeah. There will be a few of those, but not many.
There will be a fair amount of defriending going on. Dave, you're right. You're right. Now
I can see this cover wrapped around a brick and delivered, special delivery to your house.
Yes, right through my plate glass window. Dave, you're right. This is one of the most controversial books, I think, that has been written in the last 100 years. And yet it needs to be written. And Dave, you know, I'm a great books kind of guy. But as I've said many, many times in this program, great books put the Christians first. Prioritize the Christian authors. Those who are born again, Trinitarian Christians who've written great stuff. Yeah, have your kids study the great books, but it better be the Christians first. And then have them read those that were self-consciously humanists, transcendentalists, the Greeks, etc., people who were self-consciously anti-God in their social theory, the political theory, their epistemology, the metaphysics and ethics. Lay out the battle lines, tear these people apart, be sure that there is a lot of blood in the classroom as you're engaging the greats, the great men who did everything they could to establish humanist systems and effectively destroy Western civilization. And Dave, this mixture is the problem. The mixture, the anthologies in the classrooms are a problem. When you mix humanist ideas with the Christian foundations in the West, as Shakespeare does very well, and I point that out in my book, I know that's going to be controversial.
Well, because Shakespeare seems to be more Christian than many of the Christian authors today.
He is. He's got a strong Christian baseline. But it's not just baseline. I tell the readers, I tell our academics, you can't just look at baseline. Okay, he had 2,000 references to the King James Bible, on and on and on. Big deal. Big deal. That's the baseline. Everybody had the baseline. The question is, what's his trajectory? What's his trajectory? And is the trajectory towards humanism? Is the trajectory towards a basically humanist Greek metaphysic? And I point that out in my book, that when it comes to Macbeth, yes, there were some Christian elements to Macbeth, but the trajectory, the basic trajectory, The foundational issue when it comes to Shakespeare's view on metaphysics was a humanist pagan concept of reality. And we just got to lay that out for the kids, and they better be able to dig into that foundation and notice there's a lot of sand in that foundation of Western civilization. And as they mixed the Christian foundation with the humanism that came, of course, through Aquinas, through Locke and Shakespeare and, you know, on and on and on. As that mixture happened, Dave, the foundation, you mix a foundation of concrete with lots and lots and lots of sand of humanism. Guess what's going to happen to the infrastructure over a period of 200 to 300 years? It comes down, baby. It comes down. All right. So this is how I present it in the book. Okay. I'm okay with some great book stuff. There's some concepts in classical education that I'm okay with, but there isn't nearly enough antithesis in the education of children, especially within classical schools, especially within the Christian classical movement that's burgeoned in the homeschooling movement today. Yeah, we need to engage the ideas I presented in my book, Apostate, and I challenge people to read this book, Dave. I think it's going to introduce something very important in the conversation, and it's going to introduce a lot of confrontation in the conversation, as R.C. Jr. usually likes to say when it comes to the great books, welcome to the great confrontation. Forget about the great conversation. Let's talk about the great confrontation. It better be a great confrontation. Otherwise, all these Christian classical schools are just opening the doors for more erosion of our Christian foundations and destruction of the Christian faith in the lives of lots and lots of kids in the years to come. Yeah, I'm concerned, Dave. I'm really concerned. I think that most education, most attempts for Christian education have actually been counterproductive. Counterproductive. Largely because they've ignored the antithesis in the literature classrooms.
It seems to me, Kevin, that you're telling an old story. And the old story is this. Don't intermarry the Canaanites. Israel was told to be pure, to be holy, to have no other gods to focus on. Because the Lord knew that if they started interacting with and mingling with the Canaanite women, and there was these marriages, these ideas would come together. Yeah. And in the synthesis or the syncretism, idolatry would have to make its way in. And remember what happened to the Northern Kingdom. Northern Kingdom's marching along. Now they had some bad kings. They had lots of bad kings. They all only had bad kings. But there was one particular bad king. His name was Ahab. He married a woman named Jezebel. Jezebel was a priestess of Baal, hence her name, Jezebel. And that was amongst the very worst of the kings in the apostasy of the Northern Kingdom of Israel. They had a daughter, Athaliah. You remember Athaliah, he had married off to the king of Judah, Jehoram. And that had the same effect. The lesson is when you take something holy and you try and synchronize it and synthesize it with that which is unholy, it doesn't make the unholy thing holy. It makes the holy thing unholy.
Which ties in what happened pre-flood, Dave, when the Nephilim formed, and that was when the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were attractive, and there was intermarriage, Dave. The intermarriage created the Nephilim. The Nephilim was the catalyst to the destruction of the entire world, largely because they married the ideas, the concepts, the character of the city of God with the city of man, and that creates such an unholy alliance. They have a character, yes, a strength about it, yes, but the mixture is where you get the twisting.
Well, Jezebel was strong. So what's kind of important here is not just it's Shakespeare, or not just that it's Locke, or not just that we're talking about the ideas of Aquinas. Now, we've always had bad ideas in civilization. There were always the Canaanites who were there.
Sure.
The problem is that in our anthologies, we started to mix them together.
The mixture, yeah.
And we didn't shine the light of day and say, look how they violate the law of God here. Look at the metaphysic there. Look, you know, when we read in, when I was at a Christian college back in the early 80s, in fact, I believe it was 1980, in a Christian Lutheran college, I had classes, it was a liberal arts college, and we read things like Shakespeare. You know who we didn't read? We didn't read Bunyan.
Yeah.
Now, which was a greater English author, Shakespeare or Bunyan? Well, up till about 100 years ago, it would have been hands down Bunyan.
Or Augustine.
Or Augustine.
Versus Aristotle.
We didn't read any Augustine, but we did read Plato's Republic.
That's because Christian colleges, generally speaking, are perverted, are broken down, depraved, and they've become effectively compromised with the antithesis, friends. And when you have the antithesis, when they have the Nephilim forming out of the Christian culture, you get the Nephilim forming. You get this unholy alliance or marriage or synthesis between the ideas of the city of God and the ideas of the city of man. That's how you get Karl Marx. That's how you get Nietzsche. That's how you get Adolf Hitler. That's how you get hundreds of millions of dead bodies. All right. It doesn't come about by a couple of cannibals out in New Guinea eating each other in some decentralized tribal situation. No, 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 no. The massive empires have formed, and the massive, massive corruption of society formed out of the Nephilim from the 19th century. These were unfathomably evil men, friends. They were uncommonly powerful men that developed out of the Nephilim, the synthesis of ideas that came out of the 19th century. And my friends, I'm telling you, the same thing is happening right now, I think, in Christian classical schools. Unless the antithesis is well-defined and the battle is engaged today, right now, who in the world would like their son to grow up to be a Friedrich Nietzsche, the son of a Lutheran pastor? I mean, how in the world? Would you really want your son to grow up to become John Paul Sartre, who had six generations of Protestant pastors behind him? You really want to create the evil monsters out of your households that were created in the 19th century and 20th century from the great philosophers and the great literary and cultural leaders of previous centuries? It's education that makes a difference. Ultimately, we've got to find a way to re-enter the battle of ideas in the literature classroom and engage this idea ferociously for the case of the kingdom of God and for the salvaging of the Christian faith in the next generation. That, my friends, is why I wrote my book, Apostate.
And how can they get it, Kevin? Can they go to Barnes & Noble and pick it up? Is it up front?
It's not up front in Barnes & Noble right now, but you can get it at Amazon.com and at GenerationsWithVision.com. Friends, right now there's a pre-production sale that's going on, and we are picking up 900 copies today. We'll, of course, be ordering way more copies in the months to come. But you get your copy of Apostate right now at GenerationsWithVision.com or KevinSwanson.com. This, I believe, to be the most important book I have ever written. Largely because I think people need to know what destroyed Western civilization. We need to tell our children it was not Christians. It was the unholy alliance of ungodly ideas and the corruption of the universities that destroyed Western civilization. Our children need to know the story. They need to know it inside and out, number one, so they don't repeat it. But number two, so that when civilization comes down, at least we're going to know what happened and why it happened. Get my book, Apostate, The Men Who Destroyed the Christian World. At our website, KevinSwanson.com or GenerationsWithVision.com right now. Go to my website, KevinSwanson.com, and pick up this book. By the way, if you can't afford it and you need a copy, just let us know. You can buy it for a lot less as an ebook, as an EPUB, and you can get that at Amazon. And I think you can pick it up at our website, GenerationsWithVision.com as well. So, friends, if you can't afford it or you can't afford a hardback copy and you want to get the EPUB, go for it. Just let us know. If you'd like a copy of the book Apostate, let us know. Email me at host@kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.